If you build automated tests for living, or even if you just maintain a few CI/CD pipelines, the Friday afternoon feeling all too well.
Oh, the dread of red pipeline.
Right. You write a script, it works flawlessly on your local machine, and you push the code feeling like an absolute genius.
But then 10 minutes later.
10 minutes later, the pipeline turns red. The build failed. And it failed because a single button took half a second longer to load, or maybe a front-end developer added an invisible CSS wrapper just to fix a mobile layout issue.
Yeah, it is incredibly frustrating to watch a perfectly good application fail a test just because the script was too brittle to handle a microscopic change.
It really is. So welcome to this deep dive. You, our listener, are the crucial third person in this conversation today as we pull apart a comprehensive guide from Playwright Masters.
And today is focused entirely on mastering Playwright locators.
Exactly. Our mission today is to help you transition from writing fragile, flaky automation scripts to engineering robust test suites that actually survive UI redesigns.
Which is the dream, really.
It is the dream. And the source material uses a great metaphor right out of the gate. If Playwright automation is a vehicle, locators are the steering wheel.
I love that analogy.
Right. Because you can't click a button, you can't fill out a form, and you certainly can't verify an application state until you can reliably steer toward the correct element.
But before we can start driving this car, we have to look under the hood at the fundamental architecture. We have to understand how Playwright operates compared to older generation tools.
So we're talking about the difference between looking at a map and actually navigating the streets.
Precisely. The guide draws a strict line between a selector and a locator.
Which, I mean, in everyday engineering conversations, people tend to use those words interchangeably. I know I do.
Oh, we all do. But in Playwright, blurring that line leads to fundamentally flawed test design. You see, a selector is nothing more than the pattern you use to describe an element.
It's just the raw string of text.
Exactly. An ID like hashtag username, a CSS class like dot login button, or, a massive XPath expression traversing the DOM.
Okay, let's unpack this. So a selector is basically like an address written on an envelope.
Yes, that is a perfect way to look at it.
And so the locator would be the actual delivery driver, like the person who takes that address, navigates the neighborhood, waits for the customer, and physically hands over the package.
What's fascinating here is that older tools, like Selenium, for example, they relied heavily on raw selectors. You would query the DOM, the driver would find the element, and then you'd attempt an action.
And if the element was still hidden or animating?
The driver threw a stale element exception or just failed. It was just dropping the package at the door and running away.
So you're left with a broken test.
Right. But Playwright's locator model shifts the burden of synchronization from the engineer back to the tool.
Because it's an active proxy object.
Right, exactly. When you declare a locator, Playwright doesn't just blindly drop the package at the address. It pings the browser, checks if the element is attached to the DOM, waits for it to become visible.
Wait, it waits for CSS transitions to finish too.
It does. It ensures the element can actually receive pointer events before it ever attempts a click.
So the script fundamentally changes from an imperative set of commands, like wait for this, check that, click here.
To a declarative statement of intent.
You just declare what you want to interact with, and the locator manages the complex asynchronous timing.
It's a total game changer.
But that brings us to a really core challenge. How do you define that intent? Because, websites change constantly.
They do.
If I use a highly specific CSS selector, I'm basically tying my test to the structural layout of the DOM.
And if the locator is our delivery driver, how do we give it an address that won't break if the designers decide to remodel the house?
Exactly.
Well, the guide establishes a golden rule for this exact problem. You must locate elements the way human users understand them.
So stop thinking like a robot.
Right. Stop thinking like a machine parsing a DOM tree and start thinking with empathy for the actual user experience. Users do not care if a button is a div, a span, or an anchor tag.
They just care about what the button says.
What it says and what it does. So the documentation heavily advocates prioritizing user-facing locators, specifically methods like get by role and get by label.
Okay, let me push back on this a little bit,
Sure.
because I know a lot of experienced automation engineers listening right now will hear that and immediately think about execution speed.
The performance argument.
Yeah, because CSS selectors are evaluated natively by the browser's raw C++ engine. It's incredibly fast.
It is fast, yes.
When you use get by role, Playwright has to query the browser's accessibility tree, evaluate ARAA roles, compute accessible names. I mean, that computation inherently carries more overhead than a simple CSS query.
That's true.
So why should we take the performance hit, however small, when a structural CSS selector is mathematically more precise and executes faster? Like, shouldn't I just use div.container greater than div.child2 greater than button?
Well, that is exactly mistake number one and mistake number five from the source's beginner mistakes list.
Wait, really? Both of them?
Yes. The trade-off between raw execution speed and testability is the crux of modern automation. You might save a few milliseconds per action using that raw CSS selector.
Right.
But those milliseconds are instantly wiped out the moment a front-end developer wraps that button in a new div to fix a Flexbox alignment issue on a mobile device.
Oh, because the structural math changed.
Exactly. Yeah. The button is now the third child, not the second. Build fails, the pipeline locks, and an engineer has to spend 45 minutes debugging, updating the script, and rerunning the suite.
The dreaded maintenance overhead. So the test didn't even catch a bug, it just broke because the DOM shifted.
Which is why relying on DOM structure is flagged as a major anti-pattern. The performance overhead of querying the accessibility tree is negligible compared to the engineering hours lost to flaky test maintenance.
That makes a lot of sense when you put it like that.
And when you look at how the accessibility tree actually works, it operates parallel to the standard DOM. The browser takes the raw HTML, strips away all the visual layout containers.
Like the wrappers and the structural divs.
Right, all the spacers. And it compiles a semantic model of the page. It understands that a particular element functions as a button and has an accessible name of login.
So when I write page.getByRoleButton, name login, I am hooking into that semantic model.
Exactly.
The developer could add 10 layers of invisible structural HTML around that button tomorrow, and the test survives the redesign completely untouched.
Because the user intent hasn't changed. The button still looks and behaves like a login button to a human.
And I'm guessing getByLabel achieves the exact same resilience for form fields.
It does. Instead of querying an input field by its HTML name attribute, you query the label the human eye is actually reading on the screen.
So the test script literally begins to read like a manual test case. Find the username label and fill it in. Find the login button and click it.
The readability improvements alone make debugging significantly faster for anyone inheriting your code.
I love that. But, that makes perfect sense for a simple login form where everything is unique. What happens when thinking like a user leads to ambiguity?
What do you mean?
Well, modern web applications are heavily componentized, right? If we think about a React or Vue application powering an e-commerce storefront, a single page might render 50 different product cards.
Okay, yes.
Every single one of those cards has an identical button that says Add to Cart. So I tell Playwright to get by role button with the name Add to Cart. The user-facing intent is clear, but the target is completely ambiguous. There are 50 of them.
This introduces Playwright's strict mode.
Right.
When a locator matches multiple elements, Playwright refuses to guess which one you meant. It immediately aborts the action and throws a strict mode violation error.
Oh, wow. I feel like for engineers used to older frameworks that might just silently interact with the first match they find the DOM, that feels like a huge annoying roadblock.
It does at first.
Yeah.
But the guide is adamant that strict mode is a feature, not a bug. It is a vital feedback mechanism telling you that your locator is not specific enough to perform a safe action.
The temptation there is definitely just to bypass the error to get the test passing.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the instinct is to take that locator and append a dot first or a dot nth index method to the end of it. Just grab the first add to cart button on the page and move on.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Using dot first is basically like blindly grabbing the first black suitcase off a luggage carousel just to get out of the airport quickly.
Ah, yes, that is a great analogy.
Like, you don't even check the name tag, you just grab it. It's essentially like querying a production database for a list of users, grabbing the very first record returned, and charging their credit card, just assuming the database sort order will never ever change.
It's a massive race condition waiting to happen. Relying on DOM array indexes on dynamic sites is a trap.
Because if the e-commerce platform reorders the product layout based on inventory.
Right. The mouse that was the first product yesterday might be replaced by a $1,000 laptop today. Your script is still blindly clicking the first add to cart button it finds.
Suddenly your test is verifying the checkout flow for the wrong item.
Or failing completely because the cart total doesn't match the expected value. The index provides zero context about what you are actually interacting with.
So how do we establish that context without falling back on brittle XPath queries to traverse up and down the DOM? Like, how do we find a specific button inside a specific product card?
The guide details a concept called locator chaining and filtering, and the API design here is just brilliant.
Okay, how does it work?
Instead of searching the entire page for a button, you narrow the scope. You locate the parent container first, like the specific product row or card, and then you chain another locator to search strictly within that defined boundary.
Oh, so you find the parent first. The source highlights two distinct filtering methods for this, right?
Yeah.
Filtering by text and filtering by another locator.
Yes. And walking through how those operate under the hood really shows the power of the framework. When you use dot filter with has text keyboard, Playwright scans the internal text nodes of the parent container.
If that sounds like an efficient way to isolate a generic list item, if you know the product names, it's right there in plain text.
It is. But modern UIs are complex. What if the word keyboard also appears in a sidebar for related accessories? Or maybe inside a customer review snippet lower on the page.
Right, then text filtering might still return multiple elements.
Exactly, triggering another strict mode violation.
Which is where the second method comes in.
Yeah.
You can pass an entirely separate locator as the filter condition.
Yes. You can filter a parent container by verifying it contains a specific structural element inside of it. So you instruct Playwright to find the list item, but apply a filter looking for an internal heading element that has the accessible name of keyboard.
Okay, I see.
The engine evaluates the subtree of each list item dynamically. It isn't relying on brittle descendant axes like an XPath query. It's independently resolving a nested locator to validate the parent.
That is so elegant.
It is incredibly satisfying to use. Once it isolates that specific product card, you save it to a variable. Then you simply ask that variable to find the Add to Cart button.
So you drill down into a repeated component the exact same way a human eye scans a page.
Exactly. Find the block dedicated to the keyboard. Now look inside that block for the checkout button.
We've successfully filtered down, the locator is perfectly scoped, and the user intent is locked in. But we still have to deal with the reality of asynchronous web applications.
Yes, time.
Because what happens when the script executes faster than the browser can render the DOM? The button is there, but maybe it's disabled while an API call resolves in the background. Or maybe there's a loading spinner overlay sitting on top of it.
Handling asynchronous rendering brings up a trap that almost every automation engineer has fallen into at some point.
The hard sleep.
The hard sleep. The source guide explicitly warns against the use of arbitrary hard sleeps, like adding a wait page dot wait for timeout.
It is the dirty secret of test automation. You have a race condition, the framework is moving too fast, so you just throw a 3-second pause into the script and pray that 3 seconds is enough time for the React state to settle down.
We throw them in out of desperation. But a hard sleep is fundamentally a lose-lose scenario for your test suite.
Because 3 seconds is either too short or too long.
Right. If the back-end systems are under heavy load and the API takes 4 seconds to respond, your 3-second wait wasn't long enough. The test still flakes out and fails.
And if the system is running at peak performance?
If the button is ready in 50 milliseconds, your test is now sitting idle for 2.9 seconds.
Multiply that wasted time across a test suite with 2,000 assertions, and your CI/CD pipeline starts taking hours to execute.
And then developers start ignoring the results because the feedback loop is way too slow.
This circles back to the auto-waiting and actionability checks built into Playwright's locator proxy object, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. You do not need to manually manage the timing because the tool inherently understands the rendering lifecycle of the browser.
So what exactly is it checking before it clicks?
When a locator attempts a click, it runs through a strict diagnostic checklist. Is the element attached to the DOM? Is it visually rendered, meaning it doesn't have a CSS property hiding it? Is it stable, meaning any animation frames or sliding transitions have fully resolved? And finally, can it actually receive pointer events? Like, is there a modal overlay blocking it?
It effectively pulls the browser's rendering engine until the environment is perfectly safe for interaction. You just declare the target and trust the framework to negotiate the timing.
Exactly.
But, you know, building those declarative locators from scratch can still be really tedious, especially on legacy applications that lack good semantic structure. So what does this all mean for tools like Playwright Codegen?
Oh, Codegen.
Yeah, the tool that records your interactions in the browser and automatically generates the locators for you. Does this mean I can just turn on Codegen, let it write all my locators for me, and take the rest of the day off? Like, is my job fully automated now?
This raises a very important question. Kojin is incredibly popular, especially for teams migrating from older frameworks. You click through the workflow on the screen, and the tool writes the script in real time.
I use it frequently when exploring a new application.
But the guide clarifies a major caveat. Kojin is a discovery tool, not a replacement for locator design.
Because the machine has perfect visibility into the DOM, but it has absolutely zero context about the business logic of the application.
Exactly. It will hand you a locator, but it is ultimately just guessing based on the current state of the code. You still have to review it.
So what are we looking for when we review it?
The guide stresses that you must review generated locators using three core stability questions. First, what am I locating? You need to verify the generated code accurately describes your target.
Okay.
Second, why is this the correct element? This is a question of scope. Did it just find a generic save button, or did it find the save button specifically inside the user profile modal?
And the third question.
What could change without breaking it?
Evaluating the future-proofing of the script.
Right. If Kojin relies on a dynamically generated CSS class, you know, one of those compiled strings of random alphanumeric characters.
Ones that change every single time the application is built?
Yes. That locator is going to break on the very next deployment.
So you have to edit the generated code to ensure it meets that standard of user empathy we discussed earlier.
The source establishes a really powerful principle here. Locator stability is infinitely more valuable than locator length.
Oh, I like that.
Engineers often strive for the cleanest looking, shortest code. But an automation, a slightly more verbose locator that clearly communicates intent and scopes the element correctly, is vastly superior to a short, brittle CSS query.
It all comes back to encoding the purpose of the test into the script itself. You aren't just programming a robot to click pixels.
No, you are documenting the expected behavior of the application through the locators you choose.
So a good locator does more than just find an element. It explains why that element is the one your test intends to use.
It represents the maturation of the field, really, moving from simple script execution to true automation engineering. And if we look at the broader impact of this shift, there is a subtle detail in the source guide regarding accessibility that is completely fascinating.
Oh, the overlap between automation testing and web accessibility standards.
Right. The guide points out that when you heavily utilize get by role and locate elements by their accessible names, you are fundamentally interacting with the application the same way assistive technologies do.
Oh, wow. Because a screen reader parsing a page for a visually impaired user relies on the exact same accessibility tree that Playwright is querying.
Exactly. Screen readers don't care about your custom CSS classes or your deeply nested div structures either. They care about semantic HTML, ARIA roles, and accurate labels.
That is wild.
Now, the guide is careful to note that using these locators does not automatically mean your application passes a formal accessibility audit. Just because a button have a label doesn't mean the contrast ratio is correct, for example.
Sure.
But I want to leave you with this broader implication to mull over. Software engineers absolutely despise flaky tests. Maintaining brittle automation pipelines is widely considered one of the most miserable tasks in development.
It really is.
So because of that pain, engineers are now heavily incentivized by tools like Playwright to adopt user-facing semantic locators just to keep their test suite stable and their pipelines green.
But for those semantic locators to work, the front-end application actually has to be built with proper ARIA attributes and valid HTML standard practices.
Which leads to a brilliant realization. Could the selfish desire of automation engineers to just stop dealing with broken test scripts actually be the Trojan horse that accidentally forces the entire tech industry to build perfectly accessible semantic websites for human users?
Wait, really? We only started writing accessible code because we were tired of being paged on Friday afternoons when the CI/CD pipeline failed?
It's entirely possible.
That is an incredibly cynical yet beautiful way to look at the evolution of web development. The ultimate win-win scenario hidden deep inside a testing framework's architecture.
It just goes to show that when you align developer incentives with better user experiences, everyone wins.
That is a phenomenal insight to end on. Thank you to you, our listener, for joining us on this deep dive into Playwright locators. We encourage you to pull up your current automation scripts, look at the addresses you are handed to your framework, and ask yourself if they truly reflect user intent. Stop relying on fragile structure. Start utilizing the accessibility tree and see how it transforms the stability of your test suites. Keep exploring, and we'll catch you next time.